This is Blue Moon. It's the original fan-made Manchester City podcast. Coming up, we've got news and views from City's Week. It's your club, and this is your show.
The double treble dream is over. After penalty shootout heartbreak, we'll have to settle for a treble followed by a double. Can that be a double-double if the first double is part of a treble? Don't see why not, but now's not the time for thrashing out those details. Instead, on today's Blue Moon podcast, we'll thrash out the details of the games with Luton and Real Madrid. Then the focus turns to the FA Cup semi-final on Saturday and the Premier League trip to Brighton. We'll hear from Daniel Childs from Son of Chelsea and Ryan Adset from Siegel Social later on too. Can't put it off any longer though, let's do the thing. I'm David Mooney. With me this week is City fan and journalist with One Football, Dan Burke.
Hello.
And ready to come out as a childhood Burke working in the media from Sporting News, Dom Farrell.
Yeah, I've worn that mask well, haven't I? how are you doing?
Not too bad, thanks, Dom. Dan, you well?
I've been worse.
Yeah, a bit better though as well, haven't
they? Yeah, probably, yeah.
After a Champions League penalty shootout exit, but here we are. let's start the good vibes then on this week's show with this, because the 1894 group unveiled a brilliant banner celebrating the 192 bus against Real Madrid. Dan, you've emigrated to Berlin from Manchester. Dom, you've emigrated to Yorkshire. So what's the birthiest thing in your lives now that you're living outside this fair city? Dan, what have you done to keep connection with home?
Well, for me, I mean, I find myself in lots of situations when I'm watching City in public, in pubs usually, where I'm the only City fan in the room surrounded by people willing us to fail. And let me tell you, when we win, it's fantastic to be in that situation. When we lose, it's not so great. And last night was a case of the latter, unfortunately. Yeah. So, when we beat Liverpool last season 4-1, I was in a pub full of Liverpool fans and it was awesome. Last night I was in a pub full of German Real Madrid fans, and then when it went to extra time, loads of Bayern Munich fans piled into the room to cheer on Real Madrid for some reason as well.
Oh, which was, do they not want to get through? What is it?
I don't know. Maybe we take it as a compliment. Maybe they were terrified of the prospects of having to play City in the next round and would rather have played Real Madrid. But I mean, the more annoying thing is that Germans have learned the term oil club, and that was used quite liberally last night. So I was hoping to be able to stand up and say sort of like 1-0 to the oil club at some point, but that didn't happen, unfortunately.
Yeah. Dom, how do you keep in touch with home now that you're off the other side of the Pennines?
I mean, it's a bit different for me because I'm over there all the time, sort of immersed in all things Burke. But I think, I'm in Leeds now, but I've lived in various bits of Yorkshire for most of the last 16 years. And that hasn't really made me warm to brand Yorkshire, Yorkshire Day, Tour de Yorkshire and all that shite at all. If there's a Lancashire cricket equivalent of Burt, I am that around Roses matches. I think it's safe to say my friends over here would think I'm a knobhead about cricket and all sort of things Lancashire and Yorkshire. I mean, I know like Dan's in Berlin and there was a wall there once. I mean, Pennines, I mean, it wouldn't be the worst idea.
Yeah, natural wall there though, isn't it? That's the thing. I've driven over the Snake Pass a few times. It's treacherous.
You can always reinforce.
Yeah. Right, let's talk about the actual Champions League exit then. Like every week, this episode of the Blue Moon podcast is sponsored by Green King Sport, where football is more than a game. Make Green King your go-to destination for the season's final stretch. Why? For one, you can wash every televised City game down with delicious food and refreshing beverages. And with 900 sports clubs dotted around the UK, chances are you're within walking distance of your local Green King. Let's be honest, watching football is way better with your friends and family, unlike Dan, who has to do it on his own in Germany, all completely isolated in those rooms. Get the squad together for every televised Premier League fixture in an atmosphere that's worth sharing. That includes the upcoming game with Brighton, whenever that's played. Well, it's not whenever that's played now. We know when that's going to be played, don't we? Because of what happened last night. There we go. That includes the upcoming game with Brighton. Hard to get to, so if you're not going, you can catch it with your mates in your local Green King. And don't forget to download the Green King Sports app to enjoy exclusive competitions and discounts whenever there's a game on. So obviously, we have to come to the penalty shootout defeat against Real Madrid. Dom, penalties are a horrible way to go out, especially after playing like that in two legs, really, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, we all sort of have theories about penalty shootouts. One of mine is that diminutive, sort of silky little playmakers can't take penalties.
Well, that came to pass, didn't it?
Fair play to Luka Modric, Bernardo Silva and Mateo Kovacic. But another one, and I think this maybe goes back from the experience of watching England in so many tournaments, is the team who have legged it round after the ball and are exhausted after 120 minutes tend to fail. And, well, that didn't come to pass. I thought that the fact that City had taken all their penalty takers off, which was bold, and obviously Guardiola explained afterwards that was down to injury rather than anything, him having a mad one. I thought that might be offset by just massive fatigue for Real Madrid, but didn't prove to be the case.
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it, Dan? Because it's weird that I read a stat years ago that I can't get out of my head, and it came like it was one that I read around the. Remember, we won the League Cup final against Liverpool on penalties, and Fernandinho missed the first kick. I saw somebody like post after that game that the team that in a shootout, the team that misses the first kick weirdly tends to win. And when that happened with Modric, I was just kind of like, well, it's a good start to get off to, but like I need City to score the next one now to like really put that doubt out of my mind. And then when it didn't happen and like kind of things were escalating, I was like, oh well, this is going the way of the stats, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, when it went to penalties, I wasn't feeling great about it at all, really, especially as Haaland and De Bruyne had gone off the pitch, who were theoretically our two best takers. So yeah, it was a horrible way to go out. It's always a horrible way to lose a football match, and especially after we'd played so well. And I, you know, went into the second leg feeling really confident, to be honest. You know, the way we played in the first leg I thought was excellent. I thought we came out with that with a really good result, showed in the Bernabeu that we were the better team. And I wasn't quite expecting it to be a 4-0 drubbing like last year, but I thought we'd have it. And I thought the way we started the game quite slowly was a little bit odd. I thought, you know, perhaps we should have come out all guns blazing like we did last year and really put them under pressure. And, you know, you go a goal behind and then it's a pretty horrible game. And there was various points during the game where I thought it wasn't going to be our night. And we get back into it, probably should have won it in normal time, possibly should have won it in extra time. Then it goes to penalties and it's like, it's a toss of a coin now, isn't it? And we're out. I'm quite philosophical about it personally. You know, I think after what we did last season, I think this season has always been a bit pressure off for me, really. And I didn't expect us to win the Champions League 2 years in a row. The fact that we came this close to doing another treble, I think, is remarkable. And I think the players deserve the utmost respect and admiration for the efforts they've put in. And we've still got plenty to compete for this season. So, I'm not too upset about going out the Champions League, to be honest.
Yeah, funnily enough, at full time, I couldn't help but think of this clip that from Joe Royal when I interviewed him years ago.
Penalties, bloody penalties.
Because he just sums up the entire mood of everything. Like you've had, what, two legs and extra time to try and decide this tie, and it all comes down to like shooting from 12 yards and whether the goalkeeper guesses right or not. It's just perfect.
Penalties, bloody penalties.
It's funny you say that as well, because at one point, one of the lads that I was with last night, who's not a City fan, but he turned to me and he said, when it was 1-0 to Real Madrid, so he was like, it's not going to be City's night, this is it. And I said, hey, the Division 2 playoff final wasn't going to be our day, and look what happened there. So, you know.
Yeah. Before we move on from the kicks, Dom mentioned Bernardo's penalty. Any blame for him, Dan, going meekly down the middle? It's a perfectly valid option for a player to go down the middle, isn't it?
It was a crap penalty. I mean, I saw something on Twitter earlier, like a Real Madrid account posted that when we beat Chelsea in the community, the Carabao Cup final a few years ago, Bernardo went down the middle in that one. Kepa was the goalkeeper that day. And there was like a photo of Kepa speaking to Lunin before the penalties and maybe saying to him, Bernardo's going to put it down the middle. And maybe that was why. But even so, it was poorly executed, I thought. And, you know, I always think you should go bottom corner if you can with a penalty, really. But, you know. I don't blame Bernardo. Like, I've got nothing but love and admiration for that man, and he stepped up, he had a go, he missed it, never mind.
I'm really glad Dan said that, because I was convinced I'd seen Bernardo Silva like plop a penalty down the middle before. And I watched back the Community Shield shootout against Arsenal from this year and the Sevilla one, and he didn't do that in either of them. So I was thinking I'd kind of gone a bit mad, but thankfully, it did exist. And yeah, it's like, I think if you're going to go down the middle, you've either got to disguise it and dink it, or the option I would go for if I ended up in a bizarre situation of taking a penalty in a Champions League shootout, just absolutely leather it down the middle high, just absolutely blam the ball.
Well,
so, and he did neither.
It's funny you say that as well, because I've clipped up another part of a Wembley 99 interview, because Edison stepped up and took a penalty, and I was delighted about that, by the way. But he didn't take the penalty I expected him to take. He just stroked it into the corner. I expected him to take a more Nicky Weaver approach from his Sheffield Wednesday days. So, for those that don't know, Sheffield Wednesday against Chesterfield at Hillsborough went down as, like, it was a penalty shootout that was going on and on and on and on. And Nicky Weaver ended up taking the winning penalty. And I asked him about it years and years ago. And, like, his technique, honestly, flawless. Here's what he said.
It never, ever dawned on me that it was going to come round to me. Didn't work counting the penalties. Obviously, I'm not with the lads in the middle. That's going for a penalty. David score or miss. I walk to the side, walk back in, walk to the side. That's all you do. Don't really look at lads or anything. So I've saved the penalty, then walk to the side. And the lads was like, phew, what? I look round and all the lads on the halfway line are sort of like pointing back in. And I'm like, oh, bollock. I'm like, oh, I don't believe it. I'm going to take one here. What am I going to do? Never even thought about taking one. I thought, right, just put it in the corner, just side foot in the. And then I thought, no. Just take a goal kick, but keep your head down, and it should stay low. I thought, I've got to just belt it. And the run-up was massive, and I put my head down, and I've just pinned it straight into the roof of the net down the middle.
Honestly, if the net wasn't there, he hit it that hard. Nobody was getting the hands to it and keeping themselves safe, I promise you. So, I mean, Edison on spot kicks, Dom, that's cemented now, isn't it?
Guardiola said before that he's the best penalty taker at the club, but it wouldn't be proper him doing it in games. But with all due respect to the great man there, and I think it is maybe the best penalty ever that we've won.
It is. Genuinely, go and watch it on YouTube. It's fantastic.
It's amazing. I think Edison probably does have better technique. So I was sat next to Daniel Storey from The Eye, I think, sir, being in this parish at some point over the years. And Edison stepped up and he was like, oh God, what are you doing that for? Not now. I said, genuinely, there's no way he doesn't score. I've never been more confident in a penalty taker, which does sound ridiculous when it's the fifth penalty of a Champions League shootout. But yeah, there was no doubt. I mean, I was in the ground.
I was convinced he was kicking it out of the stadium, to be honest.
I was in the ground in Porto. We were talking about all the good Champions League nights for the pre-match training session.
Sorry, we'll bring the Spurs one up in a bit. It's fine.
Roll up. Because that was like the COVID season. They normally did a thing of open training at UEFA games where you get thrown out. You get to watch 10 or 15 minutes of training. And then you get thrown out in case, you know, you're some sort of genius who's going to communicate tactics to the other club, which is quite funny when you consider the general knowledge of me and others in my profession. But anyway, because it was COVID, they couldn't do that. So we had to just sit in there and watch City and Chelsea train for a couple of hours. And while City had a small-sided game at one half of the pitch, Edison took penalties at Scott Carson. And I think this is also on YouTube somewhere, off the UEFA feed. He scored about 20 in a row. It was like, banging everyone into the corner. So yeah, absolutely no doubts about him last night. Just a shame about the outfield players.
Yeah. More generally though, Dan, we've talked a little bit already about the performance. I mean, ultimately, it's fair to say, I think, that City just aren't at last season's level. But I think it's also important to say about that's perfectly okay, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fine. It's fine. I mean, they're at a good level as well. I mean, I thought the performance was good under the circumstances last night. You know, the way that Real Madrid got men behind the ball was very difficult to play through, and you know, there's a conversation being had about Haaland again, isn't there, and you know, him not getting any service. Like, how do you give him service when he's so well marked like that, when Real Madrid are defending so deeply? And you know, the performance levels in recent times have been really good. I think, you know, we've had our wobbles this season, but I don't know, there's been a big debate in our WhatsApp group this morning, Mooney, about whether that result counts as a defeat or a draw, or whether the unbeaten run is going on, and whether Rodri's unbeaten run is going on. I don't really have much of an opinion on that personally, but
it's definitely a draw.
I have strong thoughts. It's definitely a draw, yeah.
There we go then. So we're still unbeaten since December, and you know, you can't argue with that. And like I said, the fact that they've gone back to the well so many times this season after what they did last season, we've seen other teams, you know, have a not even nearly as good a season as we had last year and completely drop off the year after. The fact that City are still, you know, top of the league at this point, in the FA Cup semi-final this weekend, we've just gone out of the Champions League in the quarter-final, it's been a remarkable effort. And you know, I think whatever we achieve this season is just a bonus, personally, after last year. And, you know, if we go on to win the double or if we go on to win nothing, I think it's absolutely fine.
Yeah. Could they have done more over two legs, Dom?
Yeah, I think so. A little bit, because, for say, just watching back the highlights this morning to look for that, you know, because I loved looking at the penalties again, obviously. That did confirm to me that as much as City dominated last night and I think did play very well, you know, it was a pretty heroic effort, they didn't create tons of clear-cut chances, but that has been the case in the big games across the season. But I think this was a better performance than, say, or, you know, much better performance than, say, Arsenal the other week. There are a couple of things. I mean, I know Akanji doing the Stones role gets talked about a bit. That's a bit of a debate point. He's not as natural in there as Stones and Lewis, but I honestly think that was his best performance in that role last night. You know, he set up, he had a couple of really nice balls down the channel for De Bruyne in the first half when he had to create crossing opportunities. He set up the chance that De Bruyne had when he really should have won the tie. I mean, you shouldn't really be surprised with Akanji because he gets asked to do all these mad roles and he just kind of takes to them and improves in them. And I think that was his best display in that role last night. So I don't think he was a problem. I think, and the reason I don't is the fact that I thought De Bruyne and Bernardo's final ball and end product was off. Now, if they're getting lots of opportunities to show their end product isn't on the money, then everything behind them must be working all right. You know, that plan of Bernardo chipping to the back post was clearly something they were going for, but I'm not sure where the percentages are on that, given Haaland's not the best in the air. But to be fair, the deliveries to him weren't often great either. And yeah, it was little things like that. And that also brings you round to, certainly in the first half, I think given the way the season's unfolded, and I see the logic for it because he's more versatile, because De Bruyne plays where he does. Not having Foden in the middle for the entirety of that game is an error because he's earned the right to play there. And, you know, in the second half, Bernardo went out to the right wing and it wasn't like City were open to counter-attacks. If anything, they conceded fewer in the second half. So I think that's a bit of a mistake. And maybe that was a knock-on with Akanji doing the midfield thing. I wonder if Guardiola would have been more comfortable having Foden and De Bruyne in the middle. If he had Lewis or Stones tucking in with Rodri, someone of that calibre. But it's minor gripes, really, isn't it, when you've dominated the vast majority of 180 minutes against Real Madrid, much like they did in 2022 and managed to lose. I think they've dominated six games against Madrid and progressed in one of the ties, because it's the Champions League and Real Madrid have got mad voodoo, and that's just a thing, I guess.
Do you know that jingle you have for the quizzes, Mooney? Can you get him to do one when we play Real Madrid where he goes, "It's a rat fucking"? Because that's what it is every time we play them, isn't it?
I'll speak to Andy in a bit, see if I can get that sorted out. Dom mentioned Akanji doing the stepping into midfield role. And like Dom, I agree. I think I think that was one of his best doing that. But at the same time, it's pretty clear, Dan, isn't it, that he's not John Stones doing that. And I just kind of wonder if, you know, if Stones had been fit enough, he'd have probably started that game, do you reckon?
Yeah, it felt like Akanji was the kind of understudy last night, really. And he did have a good game. You know, his athleticism was really helping City get moving up the pitch. And there was times when he was trying to take on Real Madrid players and running behind and stuff like that. And there was just the other times when he was sort of getting the ball in quite tight spaces. And that's not really his game in the way that Stones has learned to play that way over the last year or so. And times when the ball was dropping to him in the box and you're thinking, I'd rather that was dropping to somebody else in that situation. There was one time, I think, when he lashed a shot over the bar with his left foot and you think, come on, a bit of composure there, wouldn't go amiss. But yeah, I think he's been one of our best players this season, Akanji. I think he's been absolutely fantastic. And I think he had a good game, did as well as you could sort of expect him to do. And you know, hopefully maybe Stones comes back in, gets into some fitness and comes into the team again towards the end of the season. But when I see Akanji's name on the team sheet, I'm never unhappy.
Mm. Let's have a pick-me-up. We're about 20 minutes in, and it feels like we've had a bit of a laugh about the Champions League exit, but we ultimately are out of the Champions League. That being said, Dom, the title race domestically, it's completely back in City's hands now.
Yeah, City probably couldn't have scripted last weekend any better. Just a remarkable turn of events on Sunday, really. It is back in City's hands. And I know we're going to talk about some people jumping the gun maybe on where that leaves the title race. It's not beyond the realms of the situation that City play their next league game, having been knocked out of the Champions League and the FA Cup and are 4 points behind. So it's...
All right, yeah, keep the mood up. Come on.
But yeah, it was... again, when people talk about sort of the inevitability of City doing things, it's like you see it last night from City's point of view, but also in Arsenal and Liverpool's performances on Sunday. Like, none of this is straightforward. It's really, really hard winning the league, particularly when you're up against other quality teams. And yeah, it felt a bit like last week overall, it felt a little bit like the... And it's not just to say they're doing it on vibes. They're a good team with an absolutely fantastic manager. But there's been an element, I think, of emotion fueling Liverpool this season. And it felt like that fuel ran out a bit over the course of their games over the last week were all poor. And then, you know, Arsenal were really good in the first half against Villa, but ran into a very, very good Villa side. You know, they're fourth in the table for a reason. And I felt Villa just preyed on that I thought it got very, very tense in the Emirates Stadium quite early in the second half, and Villa preyed on that. And it's little things like that, you know, like I said, like the tension in the ground there, sort of Liverpool maybe burning themselves out. Comparatively, City do feel like sort of old hands in just managing all those sort of things and like compartmentalising each game. And that's one of several reasons why they are very good at this and find themselves in the position they're in.
Yeah, sometimes, Dan, playing first on the Saturday and just enjoying a Sunday with no expectations is quite fun, isn't it?
Yeah, and I feel like we rarely get that opportunity. Like, we always seem to be in this position where we're playing second, we're having to catch up, or we've got games in hand and stuff like that. It is quite annoying the way things fall, but I suppose it's probably just a consequence of us going far in other competitions, really. But, I mean, all this stuff about, oh, City are top of the league without even kicking a ball. We kicked the ball five times into the goal on Saturday, actually. Like, it's not just happened by accident, has it? You know, it's been a run of form that's been really good that has got us to this point, and it does look like Arsenal and Liverpool are sort of feeling the burn, feeling the pressure a little bit. And it's in our hands, like you say, and we just got to focus on winning our games now, and we'll win the league if we win all of our games. And you're sort of still looking at the others, hoping for them to slip up. I'm wondering if they have completely shot the bolt, those two, or whether they're going to come back and make it really interesting and take it to the final day. I would like to think not, but I, my prediction is still that the title race goes to the final day.
Are you more relaxed about it all, though, now? Are you still looking at Liverpool games and Arsenal games and, as our phrase is, doing it to yourself?
I'll still be doing it to myself until the last kick of the season, absolutely, yeah. I think, you know, that it would be lovely if those two could drop some more points, but it wouldn't surprise me if they just came roaring back now and focused and put the pressure on us. So, yeah, it's I think it's going to be an interesting race still.
Think of some dynamic teammates who got it done. City have had some great partnerships down the years, whether it's De Bruyne and Haaland, Dunn and Distan, or Rosler and Walsh. But what about the perfect teammates when it comes to growing your business? That's you and Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're auctioning autographed apparel or selling sleek skis, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/bluemoon. That's all in lowercase. Go to shopify.com/bluemoon to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/bluemoon.
Get a dollop of city nostalgia every Monday. Sign up at patreon.com/bluemoonpodcast.
Dom, were you surprised at how quickly the narrative changed around the weekend? Because, you know, Saturday morning, Paul Merson's on Soccer Saturday talking about how tough the Luton game will be and how tight this title race is. Sunday evening, he's on Super Sunday in the Sky studio following Arsenal's defeat, saying it's over and City have won it. I mean, the swing of 2 points there is incredible.
That was an absolute tour de force from Merson, wasn't it? Like, just basically... spending an hour on Sky going, this is over, it's all shite, cancel your subscriptions. Like, absolutely sensational work. Yeah, I mean, and I don't direct this at Paul Merson, but I was wearily not surprised because I think that's just, for several reasons, that is the way an awful lot of people talk about City, and a lot of things around City all get conflated together because City go clear with a few games left, and it's all inevitable. It's 115 charges. It's all, you know, it all comes into this massive ball of stuff. And obviously, the reason City are in the position to win league titles again and again and again is in a large part down to the resources, down to the money they can spend, down to the people they can bring in. Obviously, because of wider circumstances with the charges, there's a lot of talk about where that money's come from, when that money came in, and how much, and it's a matter of debate, how much impact allegedly iffy sponsorship deals between 2009 and 2013 have on a team playing in 2024. I mean, you can draw your own conclusions. And then you get into this wider thing about the game's unequal and it's all imbalanced. And, you know, yeah, there are massive imbalances in elite football. I mean, we're going to go and talk about the Luton game in a minute, and Luton have done great this year. They're a really fun team to watch under Rob Edwards, but if it wasn't for points deductions, the three teams who've come up would already be down. Those inequalities are a problem. I have more of an issue when people talk about inequalities between City and the likes of fellow clubs who try to join the Super League, who have Champions League football, who spend 105 million to get Declan Rice ahead of them. You know, there comes a point where, you know, maybe Guardiola and his methods and what he does with the players and what he does time and time and time again is good. And that's more of the reason. And listen, Guardiola might leave and City will appoint a managerial duo of Pablo Zabaleta and Nigel de Jong, and they win the treble. And I'm talking out my arse. It is all about money. But do you know what? I'm not sure that's going to be true. No. But yeah, listen, it, as with so many things around City, and God, so many things around the world now, you know, we are in the confirmation bias era. People have made their minds up about stuff. So, you know, the most exciting title race in living memory turns into a 2-point lead with 18 points for each team still to get. People go, aha, see, I told you. And well, you didn't tell us, and Paul Merson didn't tell us, and no one was telling us that. So yeah, all right, crack on, basically.
I think the thing that frustrates me most, Dan, about all of this is as Dom says there about like Guardiola and the work that City put in to be like don't get me wrong, I understand City have massive advantages over other clubs, but not there are other clubs that can compete with City, and you look at the work that Guardiola and the team put in. And I actually think the exit against Real Madrid shows how hard it is for City to actually keep doing what they're doing, because games like that happen. Games like last season, they completely voided the effects of knockout football, and they just got on with the job and kind of worked hard consistently to achieve a level that they could win pretty much the lot. And you look at kind of the reductive arguments you get around it, it's like, well, it isn't just the money that has seen them achieve what they've achieved. It has been a factor in them achieving what they've achieved, but the sporting achievement is still there. The hard work that goes in to build this squad up to do what it's done just doesn't get acknowledged. And that's kind of, that results in what happens this week of it's such a big shock that Real Madrid have beaten City. It's such a big shock. Like it's so inevitable that City will now run away with the league because they're 2 points clear. It's so reductive.
Well, there's Real Madrid fans in that bar that I'm in last night going on about, oh, City spending money and all this kind of thing. I'm like, you Real Madrid? Have you seen the players you've got and the money you've spent? Like, it's, you know, the hypocrisy is remarkable sometimes, really. And I do find it annoying. But, you know, I try and look at these things objectively. And when it comes to the Premier League, I do understand that one team winning the league 4 years in a row isn't particularly healthy. It's not what the narrative demands. It's not what the newspapers demand. It's not what, you know, there's no kind of romance at this point to the City story for outsiders, and you know that's fine. And I think the fact that, you know, we're doing all this over the last year or so with 115 charges hanging over us, you know, it's a farce. And whether that's City's fault or the Premier League's fault, whoever's responsible for that, it is farcical and it does need to be sorted out as quickly as possible. And especially while there's other teams in the league being deducted points for, you know, a different thing, but it's people do group them together and think it's one and the same. And what are they going to do about City? Yeah, well, what are they going to do about City? Like, you know, that does need to be sorted out at some point. At the same time, I agree. I think at this point in City's evolution as a club, what we're achieving is 90% sporting excellence. You know, we've got arguably the best football coach ever. We've got some of the greatest players that have ever graced England. And those two things working together, it creates magic and it's wonderful to watch. And
yeah, just on the players as well. This is my argument with it all as well, is there's Haaland aside, City generally don't sign the superstar. They don't go out and get the player that everybody's after. And you look at the players that they've achieved what they've achieved with. You know, Bournemouth got relegated. They picked up Nathan Ake. Other teams could have done that. You know, Ruben Dias was not City's first choice. Other teams could have gone out and got him. Bernardo Silva, when he came from Monaco, you know, he'd obviously played a good game against City in the Champions League and done well in that Monaco side. But other teams could have gone out and got him, and they didn't. And look at the team that City have built, they haven't gone out there and just spent a load of money on all the best players and assembled, well done what PSG did, assemble the greatest players together and try and win it that way.
Yeah, it's excellent scouting, it's excellent coaching, and those two things combined have created these brilliant results that we've seen over the years. And you know, we are arguably the best English football team of all time, aren't we? And you know, people don't like that. People don't like that a club has financially doped itself into that position. And you know, let's be honest, we have financially doped ourselves. You know, there was a massive injection of cash at the start of the takeover when we were spending money on like Adebayor and Tevez and players like that. And you know, whether that was done legally or not, it remains to be seen. And you know, I have my suspicions that it probably was done a bit illegally, and maybe we'll pay the price for that one day. But The fact of the matter is, in recent years, you know, when was the last time we ended a summer with like a negative net spend? We're basically playing on the same level playing field as everybody else at this point, really. But people don't want to acknowledge that. You know, people just want to see City as the bad boys, as the evil of football, everything that's wrong with football. And you know, that's probably never going to change, really. And then when we do go 2 points clear at the top of the league with 8 games left, people just assume that we're going to go on that run and win the league, and everyone throws their hands up and goes, oh, how can we compete with this? It's impossible. And you know, that's just what we have to deal with as a club now. As you know, and I think City are a really well-run club, you know, not a club that treats its fans very well, unfortunately, but you know, it's an absolute masterclass in how to run a football club, in my opinion. And you know, what is it that the chairman has said in his interviews? Like, I'm not going to have other clubs blaming City for how poorly run they are, and that's what it boils down to. It sometimes as well, I think.
Yeah. Let's briefly touch on the Luton game, Dom, because it was a very much rotated team, the sort of team we might see this weekend against Chelsea, but we'll find that out a bit later on in the show. A couple of players I wanted to talk about from that game. First off, Matías Núñez. Some seemed particularly happy with his performance, some less so. What did you make of him?
I'm not sure he plays against Chelsea. Just to touch on the previous discussion, Núñez is the sort of guy that City detractors will point out that they can chuck 50 million quid at a guy from Wolves, start him in six Premier League games, and if it doesn't work, kind of just crack on. But yeah, he's been a funny signing because it seemed like he was the guy who came in after they didn't get Rice and didn't get Bellingham. So that's
and Paquetá.
Yeah, that's a tough gig for starters. It's becomes a tougher gig when Phil Foden now wants to play in central midfield and is doing it well. They still want to sign Paquetá. Talking of getting rid of charges hanging over people's heads. Yeah, so it's hard for him. He's clearly a good footballer. He's a technically really nice midfielder, very elegant. Drives very well at defences, carries the ball. This was the season when Guardiola was signing ball carriers. Does those sort of things well. Unfortunately, he does a lot of the quite simple City things not so well.
Like receiving the ball on the edge of your own box.
Yeah, like not falling on your face in both penalty areas. So it's hard for him because the things he does well, he's spot on at. But when it comes to the crunch in bigger games, in terms of carrying the ball and breaking lines, etc., De Bruyne and Foden do that pretty well. Grealish ain't bad at it either. And they're probably going to sign more central midfielders. So in my piece on the game last weekend, I did a little bit of provocative subheading on Matias Nunes, the Portuguese Calvin Phillips. And right, so he's not because he's playing some games. But where it becomes a thing is you start thinking, where does this bloke fit in? If the things he's good at, Guardiola trusts other people more to do when it really matters, and he's trying to sign more people who do that stuff. And then when he plays, you have instances like falling over when you threw on goal, falling over to let the opposition concede a goal. It's not great. It's a strange thing about Nunes and Kovacic, actually, because I know the summer business has been talked about a lot. And penalties aside, I think Kovacic is a lovely player and he's proved a decent bit of business. But when you look at the goals the squad lost, like with the likes of Gundogan and Mahrez leaving, I find it a little bit odd that the two central midfielders that got signed in Nunes and Kovacic, sorry, should do that Matteo Mateus thing that Guardiola kept doing earlier in the season.
Yeah, I can't keep up when he does that, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I thought you might have been clipped up. They both have, you look through their career stats, they both don't really score goals. So it's like, I think Nunes is a good player, but I'm not sure what he's here for and how he fits in long term.
Yeah. Looking more long term, though, Dan, Jeremy Doku seems to have found a bit of form again. He had a really tricky winter in that he didn't seem to be able to get going in a lot of games. He obviously had an injury and then had to come back from that as well. But against Luton, he came on and he started the game and really impacted it. And then against Madrid, he came on and actually caused real problems. So it kind of feels like he's back being a good option again, doesn't it?
Yeah, that was a fantastic goal against Luton at the weekend. Really good. And, when the game's going as it was against Real Madrid, I'm thinking, is he going to make any changes here? And you look at who's on the bench and thinking, yeah, he could put Doku on, but is he the player for this kind of game? Do we need to still keep control in this game? And I thought Grealish was playing quite well. I was quite surprised that he was taken off, but I think it was justified and, vindicated a little bit because Doku was excellent when he came on and, had a hand in the goal and gave Real Madrid something extra to think about. And he's a tricky player. He loves that little sort of drag back, when he's sort of got his back to a player and he tries to do the sort of rolls his foot over the ball. He loves that little move to get past people, and it was working well. And his end product can still leave a little bit to be desired, but he's still young, he's still bedding in. It's been an up and down first season for him, as you said, but overall I would say I've been impressed and excited by him. So I'd like to see him start at Wembley at the weekend, and let's hope he can kick on and maybe get a few more goals before the end of the season.
Yeah, and just finally on Kovacic, Dan, Dom mentioned there kind of his impact. Obviously, penalties aside, he seems to be settling in really nicely at this point.
Yeah, I mean, he was a player that I was enthusiastic about us signing in the summer. I knew that we weren't going to get a like-for-like Gundogan replacement because he's just not quite that player or at that level. But I always thought there's a player that Guardiola can work with. And yeah, he had a slow start, as players tend to do when they join City, when they're learning how to play for Pep. And he seems to be getting it a lot more now and has been really good lately. And yeah, let's not put him on penalty duties again, but that was a lovely finish against Luton. I've been impressed with him, and I'm happy to see him in the starting lineup these days, and let's hope there's more to come.
Yeah, well, it's time to talk about Chelsea and Brighton. We'll start by getting a view from Stamford Bridge. I've been speaking to Daniel Childs, who runs the Son of Chelsea podcast and YouTube channel. I started by getting his reaction to the 6-0 drubbing of Everton earlier this week.
It was a little bit of a surprise, given how comfortable the evening was after recent results, and even with the dramatic win over Man United, it has been very chaotic. First clean sheet, I think, in the Premier League since about January. The fact that by half time, the game was effectively done. And it was, I think, the perfect appetizer, the perfect starter to an important week, I think, for both clubs, right, going into Saturday. So, I couldn't have asked for more as a fan.
Yeah, what was the performance like overall? Because, watching Chelsea from afar this season, it seems you've been, I guess inconsistent would be the kindest way to put it.
Yeah, the problem is with the current team is they do have talent within them, but they have these real strange at times self-implosions, like these periods in games where you'll watch Chelsea for about 20 minutes. I think the Man United game is a perfect representation of Chelsea this season, in the sense that like the first 20, 25 minutes, Chelsea looked like a really composed, organised, fluid team who were able to pick apart some good players. But then they are able to shoot themselves in the foot inexplicably. And once they shoot themselves in the foot once, they find it very difficult to recalibrate and gain control and balance back. But then, as we have seen in recent weeks, I think about the Leicester game and the Man United games, they're able very late to surge and win the game and end what looks like a pretty dreadful situation and turn it around into one that's positive. So the fact that the Everton game was so calm, composed, and didn't really show those signs, I think was obviously for Pochettino a much needed performance after the disappointment of Sheffield United.
Yeah, I was going to say, you look at some of those results and you know, winning the game late on against United and doing the same to Leicester. And then you look at kind of the games that have fallen in between there, you know, a 2-2 draw with Burnley at Stamford Bridge, a 2-2 draw at Sheffield United. It's like, do these results just kind of come out of the blue, or is it just like really difficult to build momentum? Because, the other side of this is you look at kind of certainly in 90 minutes, not lost since the start of February. So it feels like you're kind of putting a bit of a run together as well.
Yeah, I guess that's a weird thing. When you look at that number, and I saw a stat of the Premier League table, if you just took it from like the start of January, Chelsea would be about fourth or fifth on points. It doesn't feel like that watching them. It doesn't feel like that representation is, you know, it is playing out in front of our eyes. I think the eye test tells a very different story. And I think that there is deep frustration currently that is not just solely on the performances themselves. I think when you talk about Chelsea, you have to reference external things away from the pitch. Of course, the ownership, the chaos around the club over the past 18 months, you know, these are all things that I think come into effect when Chelsea fans are talking about the club and their concerns and frustrations. So on the pitch, I think that we are seeing the signs of a wild experiment of a very young group who have been cobbled together very quickly. And I think that the lack of experience, maturity, balance within the group has shown some really wild results where, yeah, against some of the best teams in this league, Chelsea have put on some good performances, but then inexplicably are unable to beat 10-man Burnley, go away to Sheffield United and have one of their lowest XG performances of the season against a team who are one of the worst defensively. So that I think maybe explains some of the bizarre ways in which Chelsea go up and down this year from week to week.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's funny because you kind of like, you talk like that, and I think of the two games that I've watched Chelsea against City, and you've looked really good and you've caused City problems throughout. So, with that in mind, how do you expect this weekend to go?
I think the interesting thing about City is that I think in some ways it makes things a lot simpler for Pochettino and for Chelsea. I think because City are such a ball-dominant team and they have such control, and you understand that against Man City, effectively the best team in the world, you are not going to have majority of possession. You are going to have to defend deep, usually. You're going to be forced back. You're going to have to relent control in moments, and you're going to have to pick your spots. I think for Pochettino, who, of course, wants to instill this very high-pressing, at times transitional game, it works a lot smoother for him. And I think for this current Chelsea group, as we saw back in February, when Chelsea have to be the protagonists and the team that takes control in games, that kind of balance of in possession, out of possession, dealing with transitions, I think becomes a lot more problematic for this current group. I think there is a simplicity, as good as Man City are, I'm not saying that beating Man City is an easy thing, of course it's not, but in some ways it kind of forces you to mirror in on what you have to do against City. And I think maybe that helps why and explains why Chelsea's two performances against City this year have looked so convincing and high quality.
Yeah, we kind of have to talk about Cole Palmer as well, because has he been, in terms of your season, looking from the outside, it looks as if he's been the shining light. Has he been the positive story throughout?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, not just for this season, but for recent seasons. I mean, the numbers he's putting up currently are insane in terms of recent Chelsea attackers. Like, this season, I mean, one of the things for me is he's on Monday, because of those four goals, he has now matched Diego Costa's first season at Chelsea. That was the last player we had who scored that kind of level of Premier League goals in a season. He's now level with Erling Haaland. I think that's, you know, a wild number. He really is the shining light, absolutely, and has been a revelation. And you know, it just shows you how weird the transfer market is, because Chelsea spent 42 million on him, which for some clubs, I'm sure, is still a steep fee. But for Chelsea in recent times, not really. And he's proven to be a player worth double, triple that to this Chelsea team. And he, in terms of, it's remarkable, actually, and I'm sure you can speak to this as well, watching him at City, given how little football he actually had, I think under 1,000 minutes last season for Man City, up to 3,000 minutes this year. And he's taken it so calmly, so smoothly, doesn't look like anything's fazed him in this current Chelsea team as well. It's not like he's playing alongside Eden Hazard, Costa, you know, years back Lampard, you know, Drogba. He's not playing alongside the best Chelsea players, so maybe it's easier for him to settle. He's had to play in a very unassured and immature team, and he's taken that with so much responsibility and really is the star of the show, no doubt.
Yeah, I always say about this transfer that it was one that kind of works for everybody, because Palmer's got more minutes, Chelsea's got a great player, and City got more money than they expected to get for him. So It's kind of like it's worked out all round. What's he doing in particular that's really helped you this season?
Well, I think mainly it's his ability in the final third and inside the box to do things that we've required of players for a very long time. I think his finishing is his best attribute. That's not to take away from his guile, his creativity at times. But really, I've been quite surprised how much he has been the guy on the end of chances rather than making them, which maybe he would have done at Man City. And I think that it's Monday's performance against Everton is just a great demonstration of everything. Cole Palmer has been brilliant at this season. The first goal, his individual skill in a central position, taking out two or three players, a nice 1-2 with Jackson, who he has a nice relationship with, and then a wonderful piece of technique to curl it into the bottom corner. The second is kind of a very poacher's finish. It's the sort of goal I'm sure like Haaland would like to score, where, you know, a loose ball in the box, he anticipates the rebound and he gets there first. These sound like basic things, but unfortunately, watching Chelsea, even some strikers have been unable to make that movement consistently. And then you see, of course, from the penalty spot, he is simply sublime in terms of his ability to just put out all the noise, even the chaos from his own teammates and score. So he is integral. And sure, absolutely, he's been given a free rein by Mauricio Pochettino in a sense where it kind of feels like Chelsea at times are just passing the ball to Palmer and hoping something happens, which, of course, compared to other teams in European football at the current time, I mean, how many players get that sort of license to roam and be free? But it's not like he's got that license and he's being wild with it, not taking the responsibility. He's taken a responsibility in leading the team forward. So it's very hard to look at Palmer and say there's this specific thing he does well. Already at a young age, he does look like a very rounded player, which is, of course, very exciting to see.
Yeah. Obviously, then we're talking ahead of the FA Cup semi-final. How are you feeling ahead of this one? What players will be influential for you? We've obviously just talked about Palmer in depth. Who else could cause City problems?
I think when we're looking at Chelsea currently, I'm looking at Conor Gallagher, probably the second most important player for Pochettino this season. You know, has been so integral to the way Chelsea want to press from the front. How I think Gallagher helps other players, at times shields the deficiencies of other players. He's such a workhorse. He's had numbers earlier in the season. I haven't looked at it in a while, but there were comparisons done between his work off the ball in comparison to N'Golo Kante's Champions League winning season. I'm not saying those two players are the same, but when you even have a player like Gallagher even coming close to Kante, one of Kante's best season, you kind of know his work off the ball. And on the ball, I think he's got better as the season has gone on too. So Gallagher, especially, I think, from a tactical point of view, will be integral, because the way he presses, usually in kind of a front two of Jackson, and the way Chelsea, I think, were able to contain City quite effectively in the game at the Etihad in February will again be very important. I also look at a player like Malo Gusto, who I think has been one of the other shining lights this year. Looks like a really, really shrewd piece of business. I think from an attacking point of view, he's created some good goals. And defensively too, I thought he had a really good performance against Doku last time, who I suspect will likely be playing as well. So I think those players, other than the obvious ones, and I think it should be right to give a mention to Nicholas Jackson. I think now 10 Premier League goals this season. He is a very raw player, but his link-up again was demonstrated at the Etihad and on Monday against Everton. A really, really good young player who I think is kind of justifying Chelsea actually not going out there this summer and trying to sign anyone else. I think there is a valid argument to stick with Jackson and let him develop, because he looks like he links up very well and does a lot of all-round striker things that you probably want from a centre-forward in the modern game.
Yeah. How important is the FA Cup to Chelsea this season? Just looking at the league table, European football may not be out of the realms of possibility from league position. But obviously, win the FA Cup, you get there anyway. So where's the balance?
I do think if you'd ask most Chelsea fans, the FA Cup is the most important thing, because of what happened at Wembley back in February, what has happened at Wembley in recent years, the fear that if Chelsea end this season trophyless, it'll be the first time since, I believe, 2003, we've gone 2 years without silverware, which kind of shows you how ridiculous the trophy hall has been in the previous sort of last two decades. I think that it is very important for Pochettino. Now, I know Chelsea have a capability to beat Man City on Saturday, but then in a final against Man United, most likely, I'm not sure if I'd back them to win that game, weirdly. That's kind of the weird thing about this current Chelsea team. But yeah, the good thing is, in recent form, is that there kind of looks like there's two ways for Chelsea to get Europe, which didn't look the case a couple of weeks ago, even a week ago, because the teams in and around us, above us, have been dropping so many points that with Chelsea's games in hand, because of the FA Cup, there is a real chance of us getting 7th or 8th. So it's hard to say at the moment, and it's hard to give you a concrete answer, because Chelsea are so inconsistent that, you know, they've had so many opportunities from a league position to capitalise and they failed to do so. But I think also for Mauricio Pochettino, a win over Guardiola on Saturday would probably be his biggest, absolutely, in the dugout at Chelsea so far, and especially at a ground where Chelsea have suffered so much pain, and I've personally been there for a lot of that pain. I think that it would mean a lot to get to the final.
Yeah, we've got a charity bet coming up a bit later on, and I like it when we have opposition fans on, because it means I don't have to do the predictions. So how do you think the game will go, and what will your score prediction be?
Well, I'm hoping that Antonio Rudiger does us a favour and Real Madrid absolutely exhaust Man City to a point where maybe it's a little bit of a rotated side. I think obviously it's up against Chelsea. I'll go 1-0 or 2-0 to Chelsea simply because of what happened at the Etihad in February. I think if a similar game plays out, I do wonder whether City, it's always hard to say this with City because it's such a relentless winning machine, but I do wonder if there will be that focus on the Champions League, that focus on the Premier League title race, which is so tight at the current moment, that maybe just maybe there's an inch or two of percentage taken away that means that Chelsea can capitalise. But that is very much Chelsea defending near their 6 yard box and having to hit City on the counter. And as much as I credit that Chelsea performance in February, it also was a night where Erling Haaland missed a bundle of opportunities. So you always have to factor in that City have players, unlike many other teams in world football, who in a moment can change the game. So I'll go 2-0 Chelsea, but I that's not based on... I'm only saying 2-0 Chelsea based on what I saw against Man City last time, which could have... I don't think I'm unreasonable in saying could have been a 2-0 Chelsea game, or at least Chelsea could have scored a second in that second half.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast.
That was Daniel Childs from Son of Chelsea. Dom, the FA Cup semi-final is often where the games catch up with City. Guardiola rotates and they struggle. I'm thinking Liverpool 2022, Chelsea 2021, Arsenal 2020. How does this year kind of look in comparison, given they've just played 120 minutes against Real Madrid and gone out of the Champions League?
Yes, interesting. Firstly, just to say, I used to work with Dan, and I want to underline for listeners the fact that Dan is speaking about Cole Palmer in the same sentence as Diego Costa is, it's like a gargantuan thing because he's Diego Costa mad. So it's like, you basically, Cole Palmer could not be getting high praise, and I want to underline that. Right, yeah, so with the semis, I think the difference between those games you've listed and this one, is, well, certainly the Chelsea and Liverpool ones, who knows what was happening. The 2020 semi-final, I think, was the week of my birthday in July. It's like, no one knew what was going on then. That doesn't really count. But the Chelsea and Liverpool ones, those were semi-finals that they kind of chucked a bit after going through in hard Champions League quarterfinals. So we talked in the run, when we were talking about the running before, how like little mental things are so important at this time of the season. And I say chucked it. Obviously, a team of City's calibre and a coach like Guardiola is never going to throw a game. But there's a little bit that you think, oh, well, the idea that, oh, we've still got the Champions League to go for, will take a little bit of the edge off that heavily rotated team against a motivated opponent in an FA Cup semi-final. I take the point that they've played 120 minutes on Wednesday, and the fact that, as Guardiola said, De Bruyne and Haaland and Akanji came off with sort of unspecified, well, niggles, as he normally calls them.
Exhaustion, is... yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Do you see Danny Carvajal cramped up in both legs, by the way? That was good exhaustion.
I wonder just how cramped up he was, given that Real Madrid were begging for penalties at that stage. But, yeah, you know, I'm willing to give elite athletes the benefit of the doubt, having suffered cramp myself. It really hurts.
He had a horrible case of the Jeremy Dokus in both calves. But anyway, I think, yeah, so they've played a lot of games, but the other side of that is, against Palace and Luton, Guardiola was able, like I say, Foden didn't play either of those games. He was able to rest quite a few players in the build-up to this. There is 5 days between the Chelsea game and the Brighton game. And also, playing 120 minutes when you have all of the ball is not... You know, a lot of the City players will be waking up this morning, obviously, you know, feeling gutted, but they probably won't feel as physically wrecked as the likes of Carvajal. So I don't know. I don't think it's going to be like the sort of comedy Les Battersby in midfield, Moonchester on the wing 11 that some people sort of think. I think it'll be a stronger team than people anticipate. And I think it will be performance with the right kind of edge after what's happened in midweek.
Yeah, how do you see it, Dan? Because as Dom says there, the squad management in that Luton game means they could possibly pick a stronger side. You think back to certainly that Liverpool semi-final. That came amidst, you know, a really tough doubleheader against Atletico and a Premier League game against Liverpool when they were chasing Liverpool for the title. Well, the chase was between them and Liverpool for the title. This year, that league game maybe gives them a bit of leeway.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, if there's one sort of football cliche that you hear spouted a lot by players, it's that they, you know, when they've had a setback like last night, when they're hurting, when they're disappointed, what they want is a game to come as soon as possible and put it right. And I think a lot of the players who played, despite being knackered last night, will really be keen to get back on the pitch and try and win and try and chase down this double now. And I wouldn't expect like massive changes. I think there's maybe the chance that Ake comes in at left back, maybe John Stones comes in at centre back, maybe Kovacic starts, Doku starts. I wouldn't be too surprised if maybe Haaland starts on the bench and he goes with Alvarez up top and we play that way. But yeah, I think he's going to take it as seriously as possible. I think like there was a bit of a break between the next game and we've got a bit of a chance now that we're out of the Champions League to manage minutes a bit better and give people a rest. And, you know, Rodri will get a bit of a rest from time to time, which is going to be helpful. And I think they're going to go full steam ahead and really put their best foot forward and try and win this game at the weekend, because I think it's just going to be something they're going to want to do.
Yeah. Would you play Rodri this weekend, Don?
Yeah, I would, because I think we've seen the way that Chelsea have played this season that they've given us a lot of problems in, you know, attacking and the form that Palmer's in at the moment. You know, he's going to be one to worry about, and I think Rodri just gives us that extra level of solidity. And, you know, I think even against Luton last week, you saw that we just weren't quite that same controlled team despite the 5-1 win. You know, we just don't look the same without him there, and I think if he feels like he can do it, I'm sure he does, then I think Pep will play him.
Yeah. Where I wanted to bring in the Spurs Champions League exit, Dom, as we were talking about all the great nights earlier on, it's almost a case of this weekend being similar to that year, because it's like it's get back in the saddle and get on with it. What you've got two choices: you either cry about what's happened or you get on with it. And history tells us City tend to do the latter. They don't tend to feel sorry for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And Pochettino was Spurs manager that day, of course. He was also Spurs manager the Wednesday they went through. But anyway,
yeah, the other one, Ancelotti, I think, was also the manager that was against City the last time ever. The last time Edison saved a penalty.
Wow. Yeah. It's mad that he managed Everton for a year, isn't it? What was all that about? Yeah, crazy times. Well, the other thing in that that Spurs game was obviously Foden got the goal and was like the surprise star to pep things up. No pun intended. Can't believe I said pep things.
Oh, mate.
It's awful. Anyway.
Are you thinking Oscar Bob?
Yeah, big time. Yeah, I telegraphed that as much as Bernardo Fernandes in the middle. He's playing really well, and I think he starts and has a good game. Yeah, I think there are more reasons to feel positive about what might happen on Saturday from a City point of view than probably most people are feeling right now.
Yeah, well, while we're discussing nerves in that sense, a lot of fans, myself included, actually, are nervous about Brighton. Any reason to be, Dan, given that they're on a horrendous run of form lately?
Probably not, when you put it like that. But, you know, any Premier League away game, I'm nervous about, to be honest. And our away record is really good, so there's probably no reason to be. But you just, you know, there's so much quality in the league and so much that can go wrong and so much that can happen, surprisingly. And, you know, you think of the game we played against them last season, that Nciso scored the goal of the season against us. And, you know, something like that can happen, and in a tight title running. That's why it's just, I find it baffling when people just assume that City are going to win every game between now and the end of the season, because maybe it's just that sort of inbuilt pessimism you have as a fan, but you just kind of think, wow, we could lose at any point. We could lose our footing and fall off this cliff and then it's over. And, you know, and we're going to go into this game probably with points to make up on the teams above us. We'll probably be third by the time this game kicks off, would be my expectation. And then, like we said earlier in the show, the pressure's on them for City. But, you know, I think we've got a good chance of winning. And I think, you know, if we go to Brighton and play well, we'll win. But we might not play well and we might not win. So it's, I can understand why people are a bit wary of this one, for sure.
Yeah. Dom, they always cause City problems. Is there any particular reason why that is? I mean, the times it's been at the Amex where Brighton have won, it tends to be that the season's over and City have won the title already. You think of last season. Oh, okay, they drew last season. But the time before when Kinsella was sent off after, what, like 5 minutes or something ridiculous, and Brighton came from 2-0 down to win, they again, the title was already won. But I think of the games at the Etihad as well, and Brighton always seem to cause City a lot of problems.
It was good to see this week that Cancelo's taken that nonsense out of his game, isn't it? anyway, yeah. Well, I mean, I think in this instance now with De Zerbi, you know, he plays a very sort of extreme man-to-man, high-pressing, high-intensity sort of game. You know, a different Italian coach's approach to what Ancelotti had last night, it's safe to say. And I think whereas a lot of teams will sort of go into their shell a little bit if City get on top, Brighton are never going to do that, and they're going to keep coming and coming. So that means there will be chances. Let's say the way that the home game this season turned around, like City are 2-0 up before half-time, I don't think there's many teams in the league that ends up 2-1 against. I think there's an element of, whether it's subconsciously or sort of more explicitly, a team that are 2-0 down at the Etihad, there will be a thing of like, right, let's not get battered. But that doesn't even come into the calculation for them. And they have had a tough season with injuries, you know, particularly Matoma, who I think is a fabulous player who's out for the rest of the season. And I know Brighton have got this great scouting where they always replace big players who leave, but I think McAllister and Caicedo leaving in the same summer was a little bit of a bridge too far, even for them to sort of...
To bridge.
Yeah.
bridge to bridge, yeah.
Did I mention I've not had a lot of sleep? Anyway, but I think the one thing that does make Brighton dangerous is they look like the sort of team where you can have a side who have had a season that's gone below expectations, so they're not going for what they were maybe gunning for in terms of European qualification, quite as, you know, that's not firmly in their sights. But there comes a point where that flips and the pressure's off and they can just play with abandon. And I don't think Brighton, funnily enough, are the sort of team who would end up on the beach, despite the convenience of that. because of how they play and because of their coach, I think when the pressure's off, you could just get a really good performance out of them. And I can see it being a really competitive game, but one that, you know, maybe City's extra edge of going for another title should get them over the line.
Yeah. If you were going to be on the beach, though, would you rather it be a sandy beach or a pebbly beach? And that, I think that might be Brighton's issue.
Yeah, very possibly. So I lived in Malta for a bit when I wasn't in Yorkshire, and most of their beaches are rocky, which sounds terrible, but you get home, you've got no sand in your shoes or anywhere else, you can just sit on the beach, no fuss, it's bang on. Lot to be said for a rocky beach.
Yeah, I'm not sure about Brighton's pebbles though, so I can understand, like, if they were going to go to the beach, they've actually probably still got a journey, if you know what I mean. So
I think pebbles is worst of both worlds, really.
Yeah. Dan, when you think of kind of like the situation in the league, and we talked earlier about doing it to yourself about whether Liverpool and Arsenal will drop points, you talked earlier about the potential for City to be behind. Does that psychologically have any effect to this City team anymore? It might do for Arsenal and Liverpool, having not won the titles as frequently as City have in the past. But you look at how City have dealt with these setbacks recently, and you look at season on season what they do. And we're talking about the way the narrative changed earlier in the show. You kind of feel like the narrative changes because City are very good at dealing with this sort of stuff.
Yeah, I would expect it wouldn't have much effect on them. And I mean, I'm sure we've all watched at least some of the Netflix documentary, and that gives you a great insight into their mindset and the way that Pep prepares them for games and the things he says to them. And, you know, I think one of the things that I keep thinking about when I watch City at the moment is the thing that Pep said a lot during last season, is that we are ourselves and they will be themselves going into these games. And they will, you know, they were themselves against Real Madrid, they were themselves against Luton, and they've been themselves for much of the season, really. And that's all you can ask for, really. You just go into games with that honest approach. Let's do our best and let's see what we can do, and don't worry about what's going on outside. Shut out the noise a little bit, and you know that we know our task is clear now. We win every game, we win the league, and that's the focus. And if there are setbacks along the way, you deal with them when they come, and just try not to focus on what Arsenal and Liverpool are doing. Like I said a minute ago, I would expect us them to win their next two games, Maybe they won't. Liverpool got Fulham away at the weekend, which is quite a tricky one, and then Everton away, which, you know, who knows how that could happen. Everton are in horrible form and never seem to beat Liverpool at Goodison, but you never know. And then Arsenal got Wolves away and Chelsea at home, I believe. So I would expect them to get 6 points there. That's just how it is. And if they drop points, it's a bonus and it gives us even more of an opportunity. But I think we've just got to think of it as win every game.
Wolves away and Chelsea at home, two games that City didn't win. So you never know. You never know. Predictions coming up shortly. But first, let's get a view from the South Coast. I spoke to Ryan Adsett, who is a Brighton fan and runs Seagulls socials, to see how their form is going into this one.
I think it's been a tough few months. Season, really. But I think particularly last few months, the injuries are just ridiculous. I think only Brentford have had more than us, but you know, there's definitely a case there to say in the positions we've had them in, we've had some horrendous injuries. And, you know, obviously being Kerem Mitoma, Solly March being our biggest point of attack last season and beginning of this season, to lose that for such a long period of time. Julio Enciso, João Pedro have also been missing for large chunks of the season. We've had to rotate our goalkeepers and our defence. So it's been a very makeshift season, you know, mixing in with a bit of losing Caicedo, McAllister. it's been a hard one, you know, obviously with the Europa League's first ever season. We're playing more games than normal. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of naivety maybe from if you look back on the summer and where we are now and the club we are. But, yeah, for the current form, I must admit, if we get anything out of this game, if we even have more than four shots, I will be very, very, very surprised, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, how performance has been recently? Because you swap players around and you take players in and out with injuries. It hampers performances, doesn't it?
Yeah. I don't even think we've played that well, to be honest, for a while. You know, Burnley was only because of an own goal. To be honest, I don't think we would have actually scored in that game. I think Burnley would have beaten us. Probably they would say they could have done and should have done. But yeah, I don't think we've played well for a while. It's a shame because this isn't the normal Brighton thing that I would be saying. I'd be saying that, you know, we're a good team and we compete with anyone. I still think we are that team, but I think with what we've had to go through in the amount of minutes we've got to manage, and, you know, obviously Purvis Estupiñán is our starting left back, never really came back from his injury properly, and now he's injured again against Burnley. So it looks like we're going to have to be putting another centre back at left back against you guys, or giving Valentin Barco a run out, which I think would be suicide for his initial career. Yeah, we've got a bit of a depleted squad, to put it lightly. So I'd be very surprised if we do anything that impressive based on performances in the last couple of months. I think we're the lowest scorers. We haven't scored really in open place for five games or something like that.
Yeah, it's just looking at your home form, though, it seems pretty good. That Arsenal game aside, it seems pretty good. So is that a factor in this game, do you think?
Possibly. You know, there's always that bit of confidence from playing at home when you're against a big team, as you've seen in the past with, you know, Brighton City as well. We've had a couple of good moments. But I don't think, you know, we've drawn a lot of those games. A lot of those games have been drop points. I'm looking at Sheffield United 1-0. I'm looking at Everton 1-0. These are teams down the bottom. Burnley the same. You know, there's a lot of games in there where we should have won, Fulham, but didn't. So, yes, it's a good record in the sense of we haven't lost. And that's what's kept us in the top half so far. But we do need to start turning them into wins. And with our current run in now, I would be quite surprised to see where that comes from. Even Bournemouth is our last team outside of the big six, if you include Newcastle these days. And they're very good as well. So yeah, it'll be tough, mate. I'll put it that way.
It's interesting that, I mean, at the time of recording, we don't know exactly when this game's going to be played because we're speaking ahead of City's game with Real Madrid. It might be the Wednesday night, might be the Thursday night. But either way, you'll have had kind of 11, 12 days off since the Burnley game. Is that an opportunity for a bit of a reset to kind of get a bit of rest into the players and get a few players back, maybe?
Definitely. You know, I think it's definitely needed. I must admit, I'd quite like to see a couple of our younger players come in. I thought we saw Marnie, I'll keep saying his name wrong. But he's our new Irish sort of kid that's come on and looks very impressive. So maybe it's a chance for those to, you know, mix in with the first team a bit more. You know, he's got his Premier League debut under his belt now. So there's another one to add to the list of Brighton products. But at the same time, I don't think we've got too many to return. I think most of them are out for the season now. Hinchelwood, Mitoma definitely won't be anywhere near the first team. But Billy Gilmore, potentially, we could see him, and we have missed him a lot. So there's an opportunity there for a bit of rest and a little bit of a reset. You know, some time away from the De Zerbi swirling rumours as well. That's been going all over Twitter recently, which probably hasn't helped to some of the bad form.
Yeah. When it comes to this game, you've mentioned injuries. Do you know who's going to be available, who's going to be back for this one?
From my understanding at this moment in time, I don't know. I don't think there's anyone. Maybe you could see Tarek. Maybe you could see Gilmore. But I'd argue that Gilmore's is probably a little bit too early. The good thing is it gives João Pedro some extra rest. I don't think he's supposed to be playing 90 minutes, and he's played 90 and 88. so that's probably not the best mix, but it gives him another rest as well, because we all know how good João Pedro is on his day. I don't think there's too many others to come back, in all honesty. I think most of them are out for the rest of this season now, which is a shame, because I think if all of those players were playing, we did have Mitoma, Pedro on form, and then Ciso, you know, happy to actually play a full game. It's a good game, City against Brighton, with a full team and the two managers that like to try and outthink each other. But unfortunately, I think it will be one of those where we have a bit of a lesser squad, perhaps. You know, the wings have been our biggest problem this season, because obviously losing Mitoma March has been so hard. So it'll be a dinger, I'd assume, against you guys, which on recent form is probably not the best. But we'll see. I've got to go with some confidence anyway. Otherwise, what's the point in going?
Yeah. In terms of kind of the overall picture, what are you hoping for the end of the season? You've mentioned kind of like a tough fixture list, and I've just had a look there. Bournemouth away, Villa at home, Newcastle away, Chelsea at home, United at home to finish. What are you hoping for the end of the season now? Because like in terms of a league position, European football may be a little bit of a stretch, but I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing for next season. Gets you to be able to kind of rebuild to that sort of level that you were the season before.
Yeah, I agree with you. I do think it would actually do us a favour in not getting Europe. And I wonder sometimes if that's the message that's gone across. But at the same time, De Zerbi's a winner and wants to get in every competition. I think in both senses, it's a good thing, right? I think the optimist in me looks at them games and I say, well, we've got to play the games. We've got to play the teams above us. So therefore, if we beat them, we go above them. So, you know, by that logic, there's an opportunity there. Those games against Manchester United, Chelsea and Newcastle back-to-back last three games could be hugely decisive on how that sort of Europa League, Conference League finishes up. But I agree with the sense of, yes, summer's going to be big for us. I think the memo across the club at the moment is to go and be a regular European competing team. You know, from once being a team that wants to scrape survival to then being a team that wants to finish mid-table. You know, I think that shift is changing. So maybe we could see a good summer if we do avoid a European competition and almost go into next season all guns blazing again like we did the year before. It could do us good.
Yeah. Are you worried about De Zerbi? Because he's someone who is you know, regularly been touted as Guardiola's successor. You know, there's plenty of clubs this summer that are going to be looking for a manager. And I mean, in terms of the football he plays, we know Guardiola steals ideas from him. So he's obviously kind of very well respected.
He is. But no, I'm not worried. I think the joy of being a Brighton fan is that we trust the club immensely. So even if on the 1% chance something happens, I would back the club to find a suitable replacement 100%. And I'd imagine that replacement's already on a little piece of paper in Tony Bloom's office at the moment. But I'm not worried. No, I'm not worried at all. And I think De Zerbi's shown a lot of naivety this season as well in himself. Maybe some of the comments in the media have sort of crept into the fans, maybe thinking, don't push it. Whilst we do agree with his frustrations of, you know, losing our best players, I get it. But at the same time, we are Brighton, right? As we always have to remember. But I'm not in a position where I'm concerned, no, because I don't think he's ready to go to that next step yet. Yes, he has a new idea. Yes, he's very diverse and very forward thinking in the beautiful game that is. But I don't think he's ready for a top job, because I don't think he's actually ready to be consistently the Brighton, you know, man himself that he should be, to be linked with Bayern Munich.
Yeah. Let's finish then, Ryan, with a quick look in kind of how this game could play out. How are you feeling the game will go? And we've got the charity bet coming up, so let's have a score prediction as well.
Okay. The score prediction I'd love to avoid.
why do you think I give them to the guests all the time? I don't want to do it.
Oh, it must be so fun being a City fan doing that, you know, because when I'm a Brighton fan, I hope for a win. With City fans, you're just thinking, you could try and win, and, you know, you'd be very lucky to. But I think we'll lose, if I'm honest. I don't have much confidence at the moment, as you can probably tell. So I'd say, should I be optimistic? Should I give you some good content? Because there's no point in me saying we're going to lose 2-0. Otherwise, I may as well not go to the game.
if you predict a Brighton win or a draw and it comes in, doesn't it? There's only one of the three correct scores can come in.
That's very true. So let's go with the draw. Let's go with a 1-1. That is absolutely ridiculous. There's absolutely no way that happens. If you guys don't win the league this season, I'd be very shocked as well. I think it's in your hands now. So I'm going to say we're going to stop you and go 1-1, and everything's going to be great, and we're on that European push towards the end of the season, if you believe me.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
That was Ryan Adsett from Seagull's Socials. Time for the charity bet. We've raised £1,040 so far this season. William Hill is giving us 3 £10 correct score singles on City's games. The winnings are going to the Man City Fans Food Bank Support Group, and we got 2 chances to add to the total this week. We've already heard from Daniel that he thinks Chelsea will win the FA Cup semi-final 2-0. That's 35-1 and £350 if he's right. Dan, what are you having for this?
I'm going to go 2-1 to City.
2-1 City is 15-2 and £75. Dom, over to you.
Gone 3-1 City.
That's 11-1 and £110 if you're right. That brings us on to Brighton. We heard Ryan go for a 1-1 draw there. That's 17-2 and £85. Dom, what are you having?
Same as the own game. I've gone 2-1 City.
2-1 City, 15-2 and £75 if you're right there. Dan, over to you.
I'm going to go 1-0 City.
Oh, really tight. 1-0. 10-1 and £100 if you are right. Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for information on how to gamble responsibly, take a look at begambleaware.org. We are going to finish with a few listener questions, which means Higgy will not be disappointed to hear that I've clipped this up from last week.
It's the listeners' questions. It's the listeners' questions. Don't be giving us lots of flannel or suggesting it's Ask the Panel, because it's not called that. All right. It's called It's the Listener's Questions. Make it thoughtful or inventive. Try to provide an answered incentive. It's the Listener's Questions. Thank you.
There we go. Okay.
The spirit of Marky Smith is alive and well.
Yes, it is. I tried to add some music to it, but he keeps drifting in and out of different tempos, it's really hard to match some music to it. And it just sounded insane. So I've left it a cappella.
Give that man a click track.
Yeah. Yeah. We start with Richard on the emails, who says, how are there so many Real Madrid fans in the home end tonight? I know plenty of City fans who wanted to come and couldn't get tickets. So how have hundreds fallen to Madrid fans? That was sent in during the first half of the game last night. I, at halftime, put that email to the club. Obviously, we've had a really tight turnaround between the game and recording the show this morning, so we've not had a chance to get anything from the club. But if we do get any answers from the press office, we'll bring them to you in a future podcast. But, I mean, Dan, you were obviously watching it in Berlin, as we've mentioned already, so it's difficult for you to really see. But, Dom, did it feel like there were a lot of away fans in the home end last night?
It felt like there was a row full of Madrid bloggers sitting directly in front of me in the press box, behaving like dickheads. Anyway, probably totally legitimate journalists who weren't at all ridiculous at full time when some people were trying to work. Anyway,
that's a man who didn't get home to the early hours of the morning, isn't it? That's speaking frustration there.
Yeah, I said something quite flippant to one of them, and then realised he probably didn't understand the word of Grumpy Mancunian, and I've wasted that on him. But anyway, yeah. So maybe even within the plush confines of the press box, I got a little bit of that a little bit of Rich's frustration. To be honest, it doesn't sound surprising. I think a lot of people talked about this at the Madrid game last year, but obviously the Madrid fans, once the game kicks off and they get tanned 4-0, fans of the team getting that tanning are less visible. In a knife-edge game that goes to penalties, you're going to see more of them. Again, by the press box, you know, it's just behind Tunnel Club. There was plenty of Madrid fans in there and people getting cross about them. I think it's been discussed on this podcast at length in various instances that the club appear to have got things wrong around ticketing, aside from the capacity to make a good amount of money. And I would suggest, without knowing the full facts and without the club having responded, this is another matter that falls under that banner, unfortunately.
Hmm. Dan, you said in our WhatsApp group last night that the criteria seem to be a lot more strenuous for this one, which makes me wonder how it's happened.
Yeah, I read on Twitter yesterday, I don't know if it was nonsense, but apparently to qualify for a ticket, you had to have been to 5 Champions League home games in the last 2 years. And someone was saying, oh, it's going to be a mega atmosphere tonight. It's going to be, you know, proper City fans. Now, whether that is the case and those tickets have been sold on to Real Madrid fans for a big profit, then I don't know. And, you know, if you're one of those fans who've done that, I would say hang your head in shame, to be honest, because I don't think it's the right thing to do at all. And, you know,
there's also not a lot the club can do. If that is the criteria and fans have bought tickets themselves, having been to previous games and then sold them on, like, what can the club do about that?
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, and you also sent us that photo, Mooney, of that block next to where you were sitting that was all had stickers on the seats with guests on it, right? And
yeah,
that is that's just the consequence of UEFA basically owning the stadiums when Champions League games are played and being able to do whatever they want and give away as many tickets as they want to their cronies, basically. So I think the club's hands are a bit tied in that respect. But again, it doesn't really, you know, generate a good atmosphere. It doesn't, you know, make it feel like it's our club at the moment when you want all the hardcore fans to be there roaring the team on. It's really disappointing that tickets are going to people who aren't City fans, but that's just the way the cookie crumbles, it seems, in the Champions League.
Yeah. I would say that, I mean, as much as this is obviously an issue, and it was an issue at both Madrid games, also at both Madrid games, the actual City fans who were in there created an absolutely incredible atmosphere. Again, more so last year, what would have been 4-0 and been, you know, the best performance you've ever seen. But yeah, the people who were there, you know, in the right seats for the right reasons were great. And I know you mentioned at the top of the show that 1894 display was just class. The McVitie's Biscuit Factory Champions League quarterfinal is just like, come on, it's so good, so good.
Yeah, what I love most about that bit is that that's not far from where I live, and there's kind of like the meme of, oh, McVitie's are baking again, because you just get the smell of biscuit town, and it's just like, it's honestly one of the best things about living near it.
Designed by a lad in Japan as well, wasn't it, that display?
Yeah.
Incredible.
I used to live near the Sarsen's Vinegar Factory. That's a different
experience. Yeah. Final question then for this week comes from Adam T on Twitter, who says, I saw Mooney tweet that it doesn't matter whether City are guilty of the Premier League charges or not, and I'd be interested to know why. I think it really matters, and I'm dreading a guilty verdict. Which I guess is a direct question to me, really.
I was going to say, you're going to make us explain your tweets now.
I mean, you can have a go if you want, but first off, what I would say is that it was in response to one of those memes of what's an unpopular opinion that you hold. But I genuinely do think it doesn't matter. And the reason I think it doesn't matter is because ultimately everybody's decided anyway. So whether City are found guilty, if City are found guilty, then everyone goes, ah, see, I knew it. They were guilty all along. And if City are not found guilty, they go, ah, well, we all know they were guilty, but they've got away with it. So at this stage now, I genuinely think that it just does not matter what the verdict is. It only really matters what the outcome is. So I'm interested to know if you two kind of agree with that. Dan, what do you reckon?
Well, I kind of interpreted your tweet a bit differently. I thought you were kind of saying whether they're guilty or not, it doesn't matter. They're still an outstanding football team and it's a separate thing.
Well, I mean that as well.
Yeah, I mean, that would be my take on it, really. you know, let's say for argument's sake, they have this guy some funding 10 years ago. They have paid Mancini off some offshore account. Like, does that have any relevance to what's going on the pitch now? Maybe it's given them a leg up at some point. Maybe it's allowed them to sort of become the club that they are before the financial fair play drawbridge was pulled up. I don't know, really. It's not something that I spend too much time worrying about, and it's just something that other people kind of use to beat City with, isn't it? And if it wasn't that, it'd be something else. You know, there was that great tweet from Dave Walensky earlier this week where he said, let's hope that the 115 charges can be sorted out soon so the journalists can go back to disliking City for another reason, or words to that effect. And that's kind of how it is, isn't it, really? You know, even before this all happened, you know, City were not popular, were not considered some sort of romantic rags to riches story, and that's never going to change, really. It's just something we have to accept now, and that's just part of being a City fan that you have to deal with this. I just kind of roll my eyes when people say stuff like that and don't even try and get into conversations about it. So for me, whether they are guilty or not is kind of irrelevant to the sporting success, and I hope that they are, you know, exonerated in some way. But if they are not and we face a punishment, then we'll handle it.
Yeah, the other aspect that I meant with it all, Dom, as well, is that it is giving credit where credit's due, and like ultimately, whatever happens, City will not get the credit for what they've achieved, because whether or not the charges are hanging over their heads, but simply because you think of the people who were saying it really matters whether City are guilty or not, because we need to know if they've broken rules. These are rules that didn't exist when other sporting achievements of the same ilk were happening. And like then, those sporting achievements are not viewed in that context of how much money was spent and how much kind of was spent here and there, whereas cities are and always will be. And that's the kind of, that's the kind of disconnect I have with both sides of this argument. And so like ultimately, I just find it like really, I just don't really care either way.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, I would counter that slightly with, yeah, those rules didn't exist before, and whether or not they should have existed in the form they did, whether they were bought in for cynical or positive reasons, or other conversations people have, but a fundamental of sport is that you all agree to play by the rules, push the rules as much as you can on and off the field, but the rules are there and everyone plays by the rules. If someone decides they're just going to circumvent the rules and they're proven to have done so, it's not really on. And
oh, yeah, no, I accept that as right, well. Yeah. But at the same time, it's kind of how you view, just how you view the sporting achievement of it is what, like because,
oh, yeah,
the,
yeah.
because the rules are much more about the governance of it.
I mean, I try to make this point after, you know, when Ian Wright did the thing where he talked about, you know, giving City their flowers, and everyone was like, someone should talk about the charges, not like that. You know, and I made the point online that I'm not sure that how much money Eti Salat did or didn't give to City in 2013 has to do with John Stones playing attacking midfield in a Champions League final. I mean, that went down particularly well on Merseyside. But it's tricky because first of all, we can think back to Cass and when City were exonerated of all the big charges there, and everyone went, "Oh, that's good, fair enough." And so, I mean, to a large extent, you are right about people having made their minds up. Obviously, we don't know from the tweet what aspect Adam is dreading. Is it how people would view City's achievements? And then you do get into the nature of the alleged crimes, probably too strong a word, and that sort of separation from the sporting achievement that you mentioned. Because, I mean, you see sort of lunatics going, oh, it's just like Lance Armstrong. Well, it's not, though, is it? Because he pumped himself full of EPO and rode a bike fast and everywhere else. There is no separation between crime and achievement there. Again, there is big separation between a 2013 sponsorship deal and John Stones being coached to the high level he's at. That's probably not going to be a very easy argument to make if they are found guilty. There are going to be a lot of people that falls on deaf ears, and that is fine. But I think, where, as you say, a lot of people have made their mind up, and we've talked about this in different aspects around the inevitability of City earlier in the podcast. A lot of people on Twitter have made their minds up, but, you know, with due respect to the people who've put their questions in on Twitter and email, a lot of people on Twitter are gobshites. And it really doesn't matter what they or us think. This City team, what they've done, what Guardiola has done as his wider body of work as a coach over the last 15 years, is going to go down in history, and it will be remembered within the context of an Abu Dhabi takeover, within the context of the domination of the Premier League and all that. But, you know, I believe what Guardiola has done on the pitch will stand the test of time regardless. And you, when you look back on that in 20, 30 years, it's going to look very, very impressive. It's undoubtedly going to look... It's going to be easier for it to look that bit more impressive if City aren't found guilty of what they're accused of. In terms of if you're dreading a guilty verdict and having to play in League Two, I mean, don't threaten us with a good time, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean entirely. Although I kind of need them to not be in League Two, because that means that the 98-99 season is not the lowest ever point. But you know, that's a
another book out of that movie.
Yeah, that's a bridge we'll cross another time, I guess. But for now, we're going to have to call it there. That's it for today's Blue Moon podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Thanks also to my guests, Dom Farrell.
Thank you, mate.
And Dan Burke.
My pleasure.
The Brighton game is going to be on Thursday next week, which throws a spanner into the works of our recording schedule. But we will be back after that game, so keep an eye on your feed then. Stay tuned for a clip of this week's Patreon show. That's coming up. We'll see you next week.
That was the Blue Moon podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
Right, so this is how bad a fan I was. My first ever European away was the Champions League final in Istanbul.
Excellent.
And I think that's probably Berlin to Istanbul is further than Berlin to Manchester. I think it is. The flight time's definitely longer.
Yeah. Have you never done that thing where you've been somewhere and you've had to get back for the game?
No, but I've just thought of what the answer to this question is, actually. And I bet I can probably beat anybody on this podcast with this answer.
Oh, this is
I watch City in Melbourne. So that's, what, 3,000 miles?
Yeah,
but then I was living in Australia at the time. I didn't go specifically for the game, so does that count?
No, it doesn't count. You can't. Unless you went to Melbourne to watch the game.
If anything, it was like probably the closest, because it was like two stops on the subway away from my house, the stadium. So like, but that was funny, because like I was living there at the time, and what people perhaps don't think of when they think of Australia is like cold weather. And it actually does get quite cold during the winter months there, which is obviously our summer months, and it was the pre-season International Champions Cup, whatever it's called. And there was like a load of City fans who'd come over for it wearing like shorts and t-shirt, and it was like 4 degrees out, and they just thought, oh, Australia, it's going to be like shrimp on the barbie and all that kind of thing, and it wasn't.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast, and join us again next time for another episode.